Begin a new series this evening. I've changed my mind on that. Not on the new series. We will, God willing, begin it in a couple of weeks, but we're not going to begin it this evening. Instead, I would like us to go to Psalm 139, which we read earlier on in our service. And it's really verses 11 to 18, kind of middle section, large middle section of the psalm that we'll be looking at this evening. We will be touching on the psalm in a wider sense, but particularly verses 11 to 18 we'll be looking at. And there are three things then that I want to draw to your attention in these verses. And first of all, a haunting consideration. A haunting consideration. Now, in order to understand then what's going on in verse 11, where, as I say, our text this evening really begins, you first of all have to get a feel for verses 1 to 10. 2 weeks ago, in connection with our studies in Exodus, we sang verses 1 to 10 of this psalm. I did also touch on them briefly in the sermon that morning. I think they are some of the most extraordinary verses in the Bible. They lay bare the heart of God in a most startling manner. They expose the almost overbearing intensity of his commitment and devotion to his people, and not simply his people en masse. Rather, every member of his people is individually the object of this commitment and devotion. That comes across unmistakably in all the first person singular pronouns. I, me, my. Let me show you what I mean then about this overbearing intensity. Verses 1 to 6, first of all, focus on what I'm going to call God's obsessive interest in the believer. If you're married, then verses 2 to 4 may strike a chord with you. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. Perhaps you're so familiar with your husband or wife's ways that you know exactly when in the day your spouse will sit down with a cup of coffee. And that approximately 12 and a half minutes later, with a sigh or a hey-ho, he or she will get out of that chair and resume some activity or other. You know those little details. You discern my thoughts from afar. Perhaps oftentimes you know exactly what your spouse is thinking. Driving home from some social occasion, you'll say, darling, when that guy at our table started venting his political opinions like that, I knew you were thinking such and such. And your spouse will reply, yes, that's precisely what I was thinking. Even before a word is on my tongue, you know it altogether. Perhaps there are occasions when you're watching TV or something, and your husband or wife passes a comment, and immediately you chuckle and exclaim, I knew you were going to say that. I'm saying verses 2 to 4, they describe the kind of detailed familiarity with another person's thoughts, expressions, and routines which you normally get within a marriage. But the psalmist here isn't talking about his spouse. It isn't his wife he's saying is this in tune with the intricacies of his life. It's God. The great eternal God. This God who has a universe to run. And to whom you would have thought one man sitting down and rising up would be utterly inconsequential, he knows the psalmist in this kind of way. And he knows every believer in this kind of way. And he knows you in this kind of way. And it isn't because he knows everything. He's this infinite intelligence who effortlessly processes every datum in the cosmos. That may be true, but that's not what this is about. It isn't in some automatic way, by some special divine prerogative, that he possesses this knowledge. It's because, verse 1, you have searched me. That word searched, it conveys the idea of subjecting something to close scrutiny, studying it in a patient and sustained manner. That's how God has acquired this knowledge, and that's why I'm using this phrase, obsessive interest. What we're talking about here Is God knowing my little routines? Because like a doting spouse, he has fondly watched me every day until the patterns and rhythms of my life have become etched upon his mind. God knowing what I say in different situations, because like a doting spouse, he has hung affectionately on my every word until all my modes of expression have become an open book to him. That's what we're talking about. I wonder, does it feel to you a bit dangerous? A bit hair-raising, perhaps, to be speaking of the holy God of heaven in those terms? As an enthralled lover, unable, as it were, to get enough of you and me, obsessively interested in every little thing about us? I'm not at all surprised if it does feel a bit dangerous and a bit hair-raising. But please be clear, it's not that we are misinterpreting and distorting these verses. Rather, it's that God's commitment and devotion to us are so intense that they take us into this hair-raising, dangerous terrain where we seem a whisker away from blasphemy and from violating the dignity of Almighty God. So there's God's obsessive interest in the believer there in verses 1 to 6. And then in verses 7 to 10, there's what I'm going to call God's unfailing nearness to the believer. This idea that wherever I go, however extreme the location, he's sure to be there. And again, it's not because he exists everywhere. He's this uncontainable immensity and the universe is too small for him so that he cannot but fill its every nook and cranny. Again, that may be true, but that's not what this is about. The psalmist is describing a relationship. He's not exploring abstract philosophical ideas about the nature of God. He's describing the relationship between God and us. And it's the picture then in verses 7 to 10 of God refusing to let us out of his sight. Determinedly pursuing us, not in some kind of sinister and intimidating way, but so that when we're in some far-flung place and we get into difficulty and we need help, he can put out his right hand, verse 10, to steady us and to hold us secure. It really is stunningly beautiful. But then comes verse 11, and I think there's more going on in verse 11 than you may initially realize. I think the verse reveals a nagging concern in the psalmist's mind. His thought process goes something like this. It's wonderful, Yahweh, that even at the extremities of our planet, I'm not beyond your reach. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, verse 9, even there your hand shall lead me. It's wonderful, moreover, Yahweh, that even at the extremities of the universe, I'm not beyond your reach. If I ascend to heaven, you are there, verse 8. If I make my bed right down there in Sheol, you are there. That's all fantastic. That's wonderful. But perhaps there's a darkness, verse 11, that can close in around me and cover me, and that is so thick, within that darkness, I am inaccessible even to you. And the God whom I know will be unfailingly near to me in all other places suddenly won't be able to get to me in that terrible darkness. That's his thought process. And what's he thinking of then? What does he have in mind? What is this darkness that is worrying him so much in verse 11? It's death. It's the darkness of the grave. Darkness has that significance sometimes in the book of Psalms. The Psalm 88, verses 11 and 12, where the psalmist writes, "Is your steadfast love declared in the grave, or your faithfulness in Abaddon? Are your wonders known in the darkness, or your righteousness in the land of forgetfulness?" It's that Hebrew poetic device of parallelism, where you have two lines that go together and mean the same thing but express it in slightly different ways. And so the first line of verse 11 goes with the first line of verse 12. Is your steadfast love declared in the grave? are your wonders known in the darkness? So the grave and the darkness mean the same thing. Or then there's Psalm 143, just over the page from the psalm we're looking at, in verse 3. The enemy has pursued my soul. He has crushed my life to the ground. He has made me sit in darkness like those long dead. Darkness is the grave. It's the place where those long dead reside. And I would put it to you then that that's the significance of the darkness here in verse 11 of Psalm 139. Notice the psalmist refers in the second half of the verse to the light. That may well be short for the fuller expression, the light of life. You get it in Psalm 56, verse 13, also in Job 33, verse 30. And it's the picture then, in the second half of verse 11 there, of the light of life being extinguished in death, flickering out and leaving nothing but night remaining. And my first heading then is a haunting consideration. This is the consideration which haunts the psalmist. That there's one place even God can't get to me to be by my side and hold my hand. There are two particular spots that Isaac and Fraser and I like to go where you can jump into a very deep river from pretty high up. One is in Northumberland, the other is in the Lake District. And there's one striking difference between these two locations. The one in the Lake District has clear water. So if while messing around there you lost a shoe or a water bottle or a person, theoretically you might be able to see down into the water, see where it is and dive down and reclaim it. The one in Northumberland, on the other hand, has jet black water. If there you lost a shoe, a water bottle, or God forbid, a person, you wouldn't have a hope. You would just have to watch helplessly as it disappeared into the darkness. And the psalmist wonders in verse 11 if death is like that. And God, despite having the best intentions in the world, just has to watch helplessly as you and I disappear into death's darkness, his commitment and devotion finally having met its match. And down we go for the first time, completely and terrifyingly alone. This consideration haunts the writer. And perhaps you're a believer this evening and it haunts you too. And especially as life goes on and you feel yourself getting older and the clock ticking and time running out and death getting closer and closer. Perhaps a similar consideration to the psalmist's haunts you. What if there finally I cross a line and I step beyond the reach of even my God? Well, this is why we must move swiftly on to our second heading. We've seen a haunting consideration. Notice with me, secondly, a hopeful comparison. A hopeful comparison. As the psalmist moves then from verse 11 to verse 12, he snaps out of the haunting consideration. He banishes it. He writes there, "Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day. For darkness is as light with you." He's saying no. No. The darkness of the grave may be thick. And it may seem terribly impenetrable. But Yahweh, it will not shut you out. It will not shut you out. That's what he concludes there in verse 12. But on what basis? On what basis? Is there any basis for what he writes in verse 12? Or is he just desperately coming up here with groundless reassurances to try and drown out the haunting consideration? Well, there is a basis. Because notice verse 13 begins with the word "for." So he's now going to reveal his logic. The logic that has led him to the optimism of verse 12. Indeed, throughout verses 13 to 18 then, this is what he's doing. He's explaining the optimism of verse 12. He's revealing his logic And it goes like this. In the past, he had been in darkness. Not the darkness of the grave, but the darkness of the womb. And that was a pretty dense darkness. In verse 15, he likens it to the depths of the earth, no less. And in that darkness then, had he been out of God's reach, languishing in some lonely, forlorn inaccessibility? Not at all. On the contrary, my frame was not hidden from you, verse 15. Your eye saw my unformed substance, verse 16. And in fact, it wasn't merely a matter of God being able to see him there in the darkness of the womb. God wasn't just a spectator. He was involved. He was an actor. Verse 13, you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. Indeed, verses 17 and 18 aren't really a separate paragraph as they might initially appear. They're continuing in the same vein. We need to understand, for one thing, he's not talking about God's thoughts there at the start of verse 17 in a general sense, just God's thoughts about anything and everything. It's specifically God's thoughts about me. That's what he means. He refers to the same thing in Psalm 40, you remember, and there it's more explicit that it's his thoughts about him. And then we need to understand, for another thing, that he's not talking about God's thoughts about me in a general sense. Specifically, God's thoughts about me when I was in the womb. That's the point. That's the context. He's saying, when I was there, those 9 months in that very obscure place, out of the way, spending my days in darkness, far from being forgotten by you, Yahweh, I was at the forefront of your thoughts. You were thinking about the shape of my nose. You were thinking about the angle of my jawbone. You were thinking about what I was going to look like, how I was going to be. You were shaping me and forming me. I was this piece of work that you were busy on, crafting me in intricate detail. That's the point he's making there in verses 17 and 18. Now, why then are those thoughts that God was having for him when in the womb, why are they so precious? Your thoughts are precious to me, verse 17. Why? Why is this meaning so much to him now? He's an adult now. Why is he taking such comfort from the fact that back then in the womb, God was thinking about him so much and was busy working upon him? Well, because this is his logic then. That if in that darkness, the darkness of the womb, he was not out of God's reach and he was not inaccessible to God, then why in this other darkness that is coming, the darkness of the grave, why there should it be any different? Why there should he be out of God's reach? Why there should he be inaccessible? And that's why then my second heading is a hopeful comparison. He's comparing these two darknesses. And he's saying, in that first darkness, I wasn't forgotten. God wasn't helplessly shut out from where I was. He was there. He was crafting me. He was highly involved in my existence in the womb. In this other darkness, it will be the same. And so, believer, don't be afraid of death. Don't be afraid of death. Think of all those situations when you've prayed, Lord, be with me in this. Something coming up later in the day, later in the week, later in the month that's worrying you and frightening you. And you said, Lord, be with me in this. And the Lord has been with you in it. Don't think that when the day comes and you're lying on your deathbed, that prayer, Lord, be with me in this, will suddenly become irrelevant. That suddenly you're entering territory where that prayer no longer has any meaning. That suddenly in death you're going to be swallowed up in the blackness of that Lake District River. And God will sit on the rocks and helplessly watch you disappear from him. No. Your committed and devoted God in life will be your committed and devoted God in death. The darkness of the grave is not dark to you, verse 12. That's what the psalmist is saying. The darkness of the grave is not dark to you. You will flood it with light, and you will find me there, and you will come for me there. And I will be fine, and I will be safe, and I'll not be lost. And I'll not be forlorn and destitute, and suddenly without the one who has been with me all the years of my pilgrimage. The darkness of the grave is not dark to you. Take comfort from that, believer, facing death getting closer and closer. A haunting consideration, a hopeful comparison, but then notice with me thirdly this evening, a hearty confidence. A hearty confidence. I've talked then about how sublime and beautiful Psalm 139 is. It seems to me actually that the most epic line of all is one that can be very easily missed. And it's the last line there of verse 18, where the psalmist exclaims, "I awake, and I am still with you." And it can easily be missed, and partly just because it's so short. But it can easily be missed also, and mainly, I think, because we fail to appreciate its true meaning. He's not talking there about ordinary waking up the way you and I do every morning in our beds. I mean, he's talked about ordinary routines, hasn't he? Back in verses 2 and 3, sitting down and rising up and so on. And if this line appeared there, then perhaps we would legitimately interpret it in that way. But if that's what it's talking about here at the end of verse 18, then it's hideously anticlimactic, isn't it? If suddenly at the end of verse 18, after all that he's been talking about, he suddenly goes back to just kind of waking up in the morning in your bed and God being there then. In several Old Testament texts, waking up has a deeper significance. It refers to resurrection, no less. The Old Testament knows the doctrine of resurrection from the dead, bodily resurrection from the dead. And it uses different forms of language and imagery to depict that. And one of those is this image of waking up from sleep. Psalm 17, verse 15. "As for me, I shall behold your face in righteousness. When I awake, I shall be satisfied with your likeness." That's no ordinary waking. That's resurrection awaking. Isaiah 26, verse 19. "Your dead shall live, their bodies shall rise." So resurrection is clearly in view here. "You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy." And then, most unmistakably and most explicitly of all, Daniel chapter 12, verse 2. "Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt." And that meaning then of the word awake, it fits here. In this context, doesn't it? In Psalm 139, given how we've just interpreted the preceding verses. And you see, the psalmist is now going a step further than he has gone thus far. He's now going beyond the idea that in the darkness of the grave, I'll not be alone. That's a great idea. That's a great concept. That's a great reality. And that's something that you and I can cling to gladly this evening. But now the psalmist is going further than that. It's not simply that in the darkness of the grave I shan't be alone. There's something better. the darkness of the grave will only be temporary. The darkness of the grave will only be temporary because a morning is coming. And the bright light of a new dawn. A morning is coming when our body shall awake from death and come alive again. What a thought. Our hearts will start to beat again. Our lungs will start to inhale and exhale again. Our brains will start to send signals again. Our eyes will start to open again. And you know the best thing of all? When our eyes will open again that day, the first thing that will meet them is God Himself. I awake and I am still with you. This committed and devoted God will then be in his usual position where he's been all my life, by my side, holding my hand. That's where he will be on resurrection day. The first thing I'll see will be my God, the one who held me through life, there to hold me anew in the new world. I awake and I am still with you. And so this is the psalmist's hearty confidence. And it can be yours too if you're a believer this evening. It can be your hearty confidence in this world where death can fill us with such fear and gloom and despondency. This can be your hearty confidence. Yes, I may have to die unless Christ comes first. I may have to die. But death will not flummox God. He will be there with me in death. His light flooding its darkness. And better still, one day he'll call me out of it. Out of death's darkness. Out of death's night. To enjoy an eternity of intimate, embodied communion with him. Be confident, believer in Jesus Christ. Amen.